It's very interesting that condensed matter systems, when they have very soft low energy excitations, they have typically instabilities. For example, if that is what we are going to discuss today with Pyle's instability, the soft excitations in fermion systems manifest in a very dramatic way. It leads to many, many instabilities, including superconducting instability. In fact, this is something I should have mentioned during my talk. An electron gas is unstable towards superconductivity, in the sense even a small perturbation, a small attractive interaction will make it a superconductor. So this expresses itself as a diverging pair susceptibility. This is something that one learns in condensed matter classes, that if you calculate the pair susceptibility of a superconductor, it is divergent. The same way, if you take a ferromagnet and approach the transition temperature close to TC, the susceptibility will diverge. Yes.
What is the pair susceptibility?
Yeah, I will define it. So it's like the susceptibility to form pairing. That's called pairs. I will define it. So interacting, fermions are very susceptible because of the particular phase space nature of excitations. So let me begin with that. It's a very important point, often not mentioned in the. So suppose I have a one-dimensional metal. This is something well known. So now I want to create excitations. So if you look at carefully, I create an excitation which is not adding a particle or removing a particle, but keeping the number of particles the same, but creating internal excitations, which are called particle hole pair excitations. So I can remove a particle here and put it somewhere here. So this is a net change in energy. And the net change in momentum is this, because I transfer an electron from here to here. If you plot this EQ as some function of Q, you find this famous electron hole dispersion, which I will explain. It's very clear that for small momentum transfer, the branch starts here. Then when you come to a finite momentum here, you notice that there can be a continuum of excitations for the given particle hole pair momentum. So this continuum extends depending on excited states available. Okay. However, there is something special about here. This is the momentum KF, Fermi momentum, or Fermi wave vector. Now I can transfer a particle from here to here with zero energy. So the excitation spectrum in momentum space has a characteristic momentum at which, two momenta at which, there are copious amount of particle hole pair excitations, zero momentum and 2kf momentum. Now, 2kf momentum means very interesting that I will be able to create soft excitations if I perturb it, but with momentum 2kf. So that is where the question of Pyle's instability comes. Now, to put it in this language, what Pyle said was that, okay, now when you look at the dispersion curve in this way, there is also minus kf. So, if I disturb the system with some wave vector close to 2kf, it will create many number of these quasi-particles with momentum 2kf and minus kf. And if you imagine two waves moving with opposite momentum, it will be a wave, density, it will become a standing wave. So essentially what happens here, you create a standing wave of particle hole pairs, which becomes a density wave. So that is what Pyle suggested as Pyle's instability. I am putting it in this language. But now let me come back to the way Pyle argued. What Pyle argued is that he, in fact, specifically looked at a one-dimensional lattice of atoms with one electron per cell, per atom, and he forgot, you can ignore spin for the moment. So you have fermions hopping on a lattice, And as you know, when you do this problem, you get this famous dispersion curve, cosine of kA. The hopping, so for example, if I write this one particle Hamiltonian in the second quadrant representation like this, so an electron hops from site I to I plus j with an amplitude t, then it will give me a dispersion which is t of cosine k of a. And this k will run from minus pi by a to plus pi by a. This is the one electron Hamiltonian. Now, what Poiles argued was that if there is a coupling of this electron to the underlying lattice, the system will self-consistently distort the lattice so that it opens a gap at the Fermi level and gain energy. How do we see that? So that we see it in the, by doing the simple thing that Piles did. Let's look at the just free particle problem. Then I know the eigenstates are momentum eigenstates. Now I put a periodic potential whose strength is delta. Okay. Now in particular, I put the periodic potential where q is equal to 2kF. I'm just doing a model problem in which I'm solving the free particle problem in the presence of a periodic potential. And this is where Bragg reflection and band gap formation comes. You may remember in your elementary quantum mechanics, whenever you have a periodic potential, there will be a Bragg reflection because this potential will reflect the electron and then its momentum will change because this is a spatially varying potential. So when you do that, you can do it approximately the way Kittel describes it. For example, this scattering will be very singular or strong for states that are nearby the states whose momentum difference is 2kF. Because, for example, this potential can transfer an electron from here to here. So that perturbation will cause that transition. So to that extent, the splitting of energy levels will be stronger close to momentum of electrons here and here. So how do we see it? For example, you can reduce the problem into a simple 2x2 matrix. That is, let us look at electronic states close to Fermi momentum. Then the energy is Ek. Then I look at the corresponding problem here. This is Ek, this is, let's say, k minus q or 2kF. Then there is a delta. So this is a problem I have to solve, because instead of solving this one-dimensional problem with periodic potential using Bloch's theorems and so on, I can focus on states that are connected by this perturbation. Essentially, a state k gets connected to k plus q through this perturbation. So the problem becomes a 2x2 matrix problem. Then when you solve the problem, this problem, what you will find is there will be a gap open here. Let me call this as some V naught. I suppose this is clear because, see, when I have a potential like this, in principle, I can imagine a state here getting transformed to another state here where the change in momentum is q. But however, they are not degenerate. Their energy difference is very large. So degenerate states will have large splits. It's like doing degenerate perturbation theory. That is, two one-particle states which are degenerate in energy will have strong effect. So I can, it's enough if I focus on these states close to the Fermi level. So for your sake, I'm just, you know, I'm doing the Piles instability problem. I just pointed out that if it considers electron gas in one dimension, and look at the electron hole excitation spectrum, the spectrum looks like this. It is soft at zero momentum and also soft at 2 kF, in which you can take an electron from here and across with zero energy change, but large momentum change. So, the system is going to have a strong susceptibility for whenever there is a perturbations with this momentum. So, Pyles said that.
Astron?
Yeah.
Could you just briefly explain why you were mentioning the degeneracy? Was that just because?
Exactly. Very good.
Degeneracy.
So, now let me look at this, the quantum mechanical problem in the presence of this perturbation. So, what this perturbation will do is when you do, for example, go to momentum basis and write this Schrodinger equation in momentum basis, this will potentially will cause the matrix, non-zero matrix element between K and the K plus Q. That's what this potential does. It connects the two. So if I have a general potential V of X, this is what I have. This is the meaning of this in momentum space. Now, if the states K and K plus Q are not degenerate, are not resonant, then when I do perturbation theory, I will find there is a large energy denominator. For example, I do second order perturbation theory. There is a large energy denominator which will tell me that this effect of this matrix element will be like V naught divided by energy denominator square. But when I consider two states which are close to the Fermi level, they are have almost the same energy, but however, they are connected by a matrix element. So if I write a reduced matrix for those two k states which are connected by this momentum, it has this ek plus q, and the ek and ek plus q are very close by. Unfortunately, I can solve this problem exactly in it's a 2x2 matrix. So when I diagonalize it, I get this result. When I solve this problem, I get two eigenvalues. I am just doing 2x2 matrix analysis. So this is what I will get. So that means the maximum splitting will be there for states which are connected at these two points. So when I do that, the band structure will get modified in this particular fashion. That's what I'm saying. So Pyles argued that now suppose I say that it is getting modified, then I notice that there is an energy gain in the sense my Fermi level is here, and some of the particles close to the Fermi level, they have reduced kinetic energy, so there is an energy gain. And I can calculate the energy gain. So how do you calculate it? I calculate it by this new energy of and the old energy summed over some energy interval over the gap. And when I do this, so with little sum, what I find is, I find this delta Ek, and substitute in the integral, what you find is, you get a delta V square density of states at the Fermi level. This is coming because I am doing a summation over K around the Fermi level. So when I convert into energy, I will get a density of states at the Fermi level, and then the log Fermi energy divided by this V naught square. This is something very important. It's a very simple exercise. Please do this and substitute and evaluate it. Yes.
Sorry. What does it mean to, like, what are the bounds of this integral in K space? Because delta is something about energy, right?
Exactly. This is a potential. Sorry. So I know states will get strongly affected over a region of energy which is corresponding with the potential energy of perturbation.
But like in terms of decay, like where on the line are we integrating exactly?
Yeah. So the decay will be in this region and in this region.
Okay.
So close to the Fermi level. So when you do that, you get this very important logarithmic dependence. Because when you pull this out, yeah, this should be EMA. So when you pull this out, there will be 1 over k, and that will give you a log, because this is going to have interesting consequences. So the important point is, Pyle's noticed that the energy gain by forcing a gap at the Fermi level, I'm not doing it, I'm just forcing a gap by imagining a periodic potential, then that's the energy gain. Then of course, when I do that, I will lose energy, because how do I create this potential by deforming the underlying lattice? So the lattice was happy with the usual lattice parameter. Now it's unhappy because I have dimerized it. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, sorry, this is backing up a little bit. What exactly does that Hamiltonian say?
Yeah, this Hamiltonian says that I'm hopping I have an electron hopping on the lattice. So this is the dispersion or free electron.
I just mean like what are the letters? I can't read them very well.
This is what is lattice?
What are the letters that are written there?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Creation operator for an electron,
uh-huh.
jumping from site I to I plus 1, Hermitian conjugate. So I am just solving, this is called a tight bending model, as you are familiar with. So I go to momentum space, and this is the dispersion I get. Now I modify this model. How do I modify it? I add a periodic potential. So when you go to second quadrature representation, this is something I should have told you. It will become that is this potential will cause a scattering between k and k plus q. And so in the lowest order approximation, you can stop the connection between k and k plus q, and then do this problem, solve the one particle problem. Then you have this energy chain. So what Pyle argued was the net energy change as an electronic contribution, which goes as v square log Fermi energy divided by v naught. This is a gain in energy. Then I have a lattice, because in order to create a new periodic potential, what I have to do is, in this case, when q corresponds to this half this Fermi wave vector, this lattice is A. So you will have to dimerize the lattice. That is, bring alternate atoms together. So increase the lattice periodicity to 2A. When you do that, the electrons that are moving, now we'll see a new periodic potential connected to V, and where Q is the reciprocal lattice vector. Then that causes elastic strain according to that will give some K times U square or V square, which is the amount of change. So lattice doesn't like distortion, because equilibrium distance lattice parameter is A. Now I'm changing the lattice periodicity from A to 2A, then the electrons like it. So now you minimize it, you get an optimum. So that was the argument of Pyle's. So Pyle's argued that spontaneously the system will undergo dimerization and open a gap, and it will become an yes.
So just to make sure I understand what's happening here. What he did was he looked at this, he said, okay, let's add a periodic potential, maybe that'll do something. And he says, well, for this particular value of Q, we get a lattice potential that's like gonna cause a gap and gonna do weird things. And then we ask, okay, what could have caused that?
That's
dimerization.
Exactly. Exactly. In this particular case of one electron per site, it's dimerization. In general, it's a potential whose wavelength is 2 pi by 2 kF. That is, lambda is equal to 2 pi by Q. Q in the case that we are talking about is pi by 2.
Sure.
So So in general, so this is a very important point, because in general, if I don't have a half-filled band, I will have a charge density wave, which opens up a gap, but then there is no commensurate relation between that charge density and the entering lattice, so it can slide. So that's a very important point. That's called sliding charge density wave, because when I have a density wave which is commensurate with underlying, like 2a, the two are together. But suppose it's square root of 2a, then there is no reason, no way by which I can fit that new lattice with the old lattice. That's called incommensurate. So in that case, if you find energy, it is independent of where you are. So that's called sliding charge density wave. This is called pinned charge density wave. Commensurate and incommensurate. Yes.
Maybe you're going to get to this shortly, but so I see why, like, if I think I follow the argument for why this is the correct dispersion and this is an energy change that happens in this state, but why is it that and also that's the lattice that will happen.
Correct. Yeah.
But exactly. Why is something that is like the ground state of that particular dispersion a charge density? Why is there a charge oscillation?
Exactly. So because I have told you by word in terms of statements I told you, because this is a Hamiltonian in the absence of lattice dynamics. Now the lattice atoms are moving, so let me write down this is the energy of the atoms that are giving the electrons. So this is the lattice dynamics. Then also, you will notice, this is what is called, it's called a hopping matrix element, the probability amplitude that an electron will hop from one side to another. Now, when you do the problem carefully, you will find that this will get modified in the presence of lattice dynamics to T naught, which is the equilibrium value, plus some alpha times ui minus ua plus 1. Because if I bring the lattice together, the hopping matrix element increase. If they move it away, it will decrease. So I'm just putting that fact. So in this way, I'm coupling that. So now there will be this term will be there. So it says the coupling constant or the hopping matrix element will be modified by lattice displacements. So now I go to second quantization of Fonon variable. So this is a vertex. This tells me that an electron will get scattered from state k to k q plus q by emission or absorption of phonons. Sorry, I didn't do all these things. When Piles did not do all this, he said that there is a lattice. So when you change the potential, the pattern of the lattice, then there will be some change in energy. And he calculated the electronic energy gain as that, and then he said, so we just get the simplest argument possible and got away with it, and it's called a Piles instability. Now what I am doing, this is called a Suess-Schieffer-Heger Hamiltonian. Okay, that's good. So you see that you are with me, right? So I am just giving an idea why it's unstable, and particularly it's unstable with a wave vector which is 2kf, not any other arbitrary kf. So there is a characteristic scale given by kf, which is the Fermi momentum of electrons. Okay. Now there are many, many things associated with the trimerization and so on. I will not come to it, but I will just, having done that, now I will go to a real system which motivated Suess-Schieffer-Heger, called polyacetylene. It's a very beautiful system nature gives us. How many of you remember the structure of polyacetylene from your chemistry? So this is the formula. So you know methane, when you have a carbon atom, can get happily bound to 4 hydrogen atom, forms a molecule. Now, and you know similarly, another molecule, because carbon would like to have 4 bonds according to quantum chemistry, and so on. Now, It turns out in nature, in fact, benzene is a good example of polyacetylene, C6H6. What is benzene? It's called aniline actually. There are 6 carbon atoms and then 1 hydrogen atom attached to every carbon atom. Now imagine cutting this benzene and forming a chain. And then in benzene, you know the famous resonance that because of quantum fluctuations, it dances between this and this in the ground state. This is a very famous Pauling's resonance, Kekulé resonance. Okay, the ground state can be thought of as in which the two electrons in the pz orbital form a singlet and then they dance. But it turns out when you have a long chain of this, this is polyacetylene, you have carbon atom and then hydrogen atom attached to every carbon atom. So every vertex is a carbon atom. Then I get something remarkable happens. When the chain length is larger than about 12, there is no resonance, they get stuck. And then you get two forms of polyacetylene, in which experimentally what you find is, by this what I mean is, the two carbon atoms are close by in an alternate way. Because you notice, every carbon has to have 4 bonds. So there are 2 bonds here and 1 bond here. And this is the best way to create a 4 bond situation, right? And another way that you can create is this. This also will make carbon atoms happy because I have 4 bonds at every for carbon atom. Now, what you find is interestingly, accompanying this is nothing but Pyle's instability that you have been talking about. Let me go to a little bit of quantum chemistry. Now, when you bond a carbon atom with the other atoms, what you do is you form what is called sp3 or sp2 hybridization. In the case of benzene, you do what is called sp2 hybridization because you have a 2s orbital and a 2px and a 2py and a 2pz. And what you do is you take these 3 orbitals and form, and they are all degenerate for carbon atom, and form 3 linear combination which have this directed form. I'm just repeating what you know in quantum chemistry. So I can just take this through an orbital, form quantum mechanical linear combination. So they form these 3 orbitals which are at 120 degrees. And then in benzene, what happens is this carbon atom, which has this 3 orbital, bonds to 1 hydrogen atom and then 2 other this 2p this linear combination with the neighboring hydrogen atom. So when you do this, you create 3 bonds. Then you are left with 1 electron and 1 pz orbital. So this is what you learn in quantum chemistry. When you look at benzene, you have 1 lone electron in the 2pz orbital, which is, if I draw it schematically, it will be like this. 2pz orbital sticking out. So all the other 3 orbitals, they form bonds and they have taken away all the electrons and they are filled, they form the benzene structure. Now you are left with 1 electron in each. Now, according to Pauling, it is these 2 electrons which form a singlet bond. Because when I have 2 neighboring atoms, there is a hopping matrix element. I can form a bonding and antibonding state and put 2 electrons in the bonding state. That's a covalent bond. So now, here in benzene, it can happen in 2 ways, the way I said. And because benzene is a finite system, there is a quantum mechanical resonance between the 2. Like this is a famous quantum resonance. But then when the systems become larger and larger, when you have a benzene with a larger number of rings, then when the system, the resonance becomes difficult or the quantum tunneling becomes difficult, it gets stuck to this or this. So all this is modeled in terms of the so-called Sue-Schreifer-Heger model, which I was alluding to. Okay, now let me. So now the problem is, in fact, it's no different from what Piles discussed, except that I'm putting it in a real situation in which I get this lone electron from carbon atom after I do sp2 bonding. Then these lone electrons can hop along the chain. So if I write down the Hamiltonian for polyacetylene, I will write down the Hamiltonian for the valence electron, which is one electron. And that precisely, for example, if I write down the Hamiltonian for this, I notice already that there are two carbon atoms per unit cell. Because if I want to repeat this and then see what is the unit cell, in the absence of dimerization, every carbon atom is one unit cell. Now, after dimerization, the periodicity has increased, 2a. So I have two carbon atoms per unit cell. Now, if I write down an effective Hamiltonian for the electron that hop and form this polyacetylene state, that will look like this, W AI dagger I will explain what. So what have I done? What I have done is, I have considered two carbon atom and call it as unit, that as site I plus 1, because the unit cell has two carbon atoms. Now, because the two carbon atoms are closer, the hopping matrix in between these two is W. And then between two atoms connecting neighboring unit cells, it is V. Because here the carbon-carbon distance is expanded. Here it is contracted. So it's not very different from what Piles did, but I have written them. Now it turns out this simple looking Hamiltonian, when you put one electron per site and solve the problem, has very interesting topological property. So let me give a glimpse of why it is so in the following way.
Could you just give some context for whether they've used this SSH model to actually predict something about the original molecule they were looking
at? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what I'm going to do. Very good. So now I had given you polyacetylene with two ground states, because I said this is one. So if I have long enough polyacetylene chain, then I can have dimerization pattern like this and like this. They're degenerate ground state, like in a ferromagnet. All spins can be up or all spins can be down. Now imagine synthesizing polyacetylene. Let me call this as type A ground state. And this as type B ground state. Then imagining synthesizing polyacetylene in which the left side is A ground state, a situation in which right side is B ground state. So if I were to draw such a thing, it would look like this. OK, you agree that here, for example, if I order the sites in some way, the right inclined bonds are double bonds. Here, the left fellows are double bonds. So this is A type of ground state. This is B kind of. Now I have a situation in which I don't know what to do with this carbon atom. Because here, the extra piece, that electron is happily bonded with the neighbor, happily bonded. Here I have nobody to bond to, so I have an unpaired electron. So if we look at from simple quantum chemistry point of view, if you create a polyacetylene and bring them together and have two degenerate patterns meeting at some place, this is called a domain wall. And you immediately find out that this carbon atom will have the pz electron, which is not connected to anybody. So it's non-bonded electron. And still, it's locally neutral. Every site has the same number of electrons. So now, if you do some small experiment, you'll find an unpaired spin here, because it's not single coupled to any neighbor. So there is no singlet, no singlet bond. So these are prediction of Su Schiefer. This is called famous Su Schiefer soliton. So here is an object which I have created by connecting two degenerate ground states by hand. Then they have to meet in some place where I have a domain wall. And if you look at the electronic properties, that electron will be frustrated. It has nobody to bond to. So it will carry a spin. So this was a prediction of Su Schiefer-Higger model, experimentally, theoretically, and it was experimentally observed. So what you do is you take polyacetylene and perturb it in some way. Okay, now, Anna, is it clear?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know exactly how one would observe this.
So
but
I will go a few steps further and it will become even more clear. So now what I do is I want to create this in a situation in a very friendly way. Suppose I start with a polyacetylene like this. So you notice this is A type of ground state. This is also A type of ground state. Now what I do is I do some mischief and then create two domain walls. You notice here I have A type of ground state. In between I have B type of ground state. I go back to A type of ground state. So what I have got is I have got two sides which do not know what to do. So I go from ground state A to B to A. Then in the process I have created two domain wall. And this is something that I could do chemically or some perturbation. Now what I will have is I have created two solitons, a soliton here, an unpaired spin, another unpaired spin. So that means I have, to begin with, I had a very happy situation in which every electron coming from the pz orbital is happily paired with somebody. Here I have made two unhappy situations. So this is an excitation. This is called topological excitation. It's not very different from domain walls that you are all familiar with the ferromagnet. Suppose I take a ferromagnet. I can imagine flipping all the spins to the left. So this is type A ground state, this is type B ground state. But I can also imagine a situation in which I have two domain walls. So topology demands that either if I have a closed system, I can create domain walls only in pairs, the way you create dislocations in pairs in crystals. So similarly, the topology connected with the doubly degenerate ground state demands that you can create this only in pairs. So the prediction of Su Schiefer-Higger model is, we'll, in fact, if there is time, we'll see it clearly. When you solve the problem, the tape bending model, you will find the wave function of this electron. It won't be happily sitting here. It will spread over. And you can do numerical experiments and see the spread of the wave function through NMR and so on. So this is an unusual excitation that we have got. Because normally, if I give you a semiconductor, what do? I create electron hole pair excitation. Here, I have created an excitation which has no charge. Because if you look at this excitation, for anybody outside who is coming with an electrometer who can measure locally charge, every carbon atom will look identical because there is the same number of electrons. But however, if somebody comes with a magnetic field, local magnetic probe, he will see an unpaired spin here. So this is an excitation which carries a spin and no charge. Now I can do one more thing. I can shine light and ionize this carbon atom and remove that electron. Okay? Then it has become positively charged. So somebody coming from outside with an electrometer will measure positive charge as an excitation, but no spin. So that's unusual because if you take diamond or sodium chloride, remove an electron, you will find a missing electron or a missing hole, that means a hole, and also there will be a missing spin. There is a spin there. So electrons and whole quasi-particles are part of metals or insulating system. Here I have a very funny situation in which I have excitation which carries either a charge or a spin. So this is called quantum number fractionization. In fact, this appeared, you can do it in Thiering's model, you know, you can give field theoretic justification for it and Thiering's models, Sengarden model and so on. I have no time to go into it. So this is a very important thing. Just by playing with a tight bending model and symmetry breaking, I am creating topological excitations which carry non-trivial quantum numbers, like in the excitation that I said, if I remove this electron by force, then I am left with a missing electron which is a positive charge and no spin, because everybody is paired up. So for some alien who comes, he will see a charge without spin. Similarly, if I don't do that, I will see a spin without a charge. So these are all called spin-ons and holons. Yes.
So it's really neat how the spins and the charges separate like this. Topologically, there's
possible. Exactly. Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
It feels different. But what is the specific thing that makes this a topological excitation?
Exactly.
What in general, makes something a topological excitation, and is that always accompanied by fractionalization?
That's where all these anions. So this is a very simple example. So where it's very clear that there is a topology here, because there are two ground states. When you connect it, there is a soliton. In fact, this is was found by Jackiw and Rebbe in their model, in field theory model. So this is a condensed materialization of that. I do not know which preceded which. So here I have the symmetry that I have broken is discrete. Now, if I have a continuous symmetry, then there could be more complicated things. And there is one more thing that I will say here. Continuing along this line, suppose instead of having a polymer like this, this is called dimerization. I have trimerization. You'll find even a more esoteric fact that you can create charge 1/3 locally. Even here, if the particles have no spin, the missing charge will be half. So that's called charge fractionalization. Okay, so sorry, I'm jumping too many things. So now, having said that, now let me come to the Berry phase. So all this is encoded, all this possibility is beautifully encoded when you solve this problem in momentum space and do some analysis of the wave function in momentum space, which is related to Berry phase analysis. This is a very important point. Michael Berry, you know, started. In fact, there was a workshop in ICTS, International Center for Theoretical Sciences at Bangalore, not long back, where Michael Berry gave talks and so on. There are beautiful talks about Berry phase by various people. And I have a talk on emergent gauge fields and Berry phase. So there I explained some of these things and also other things. So now things like Berry curvature is something that you are all familiar with, right? So now what I do is I'm going to use Berry, just very briefly indicate the emergence of Berry phase, and then show how when you go to momentum space, there is a non-trivial Berry curvature which distinguishes topological phases and non-topological phases of this model, namely Su-Schiffer-Heder model. Okay, so let me. So what have I done so far? I did Pyle's instability, and then I went to a real situation, namely polyacetylene. I talked a little bit about quantum chemistry, and then it's very clear carbon atom would like to have 4 bonds, and in polyacetylene it can be happily satisfied in 2 ways. They correspond to 2 dimerization pattern in which carbon 1 and 2 are dimerized and so on. Now you can also ask the question, this is something again I missed it. You can ask the question, what will happen if you have a polyacetylene with n? Okay, let me do this for the case of dimerization. Suppose I have open chain of 2N atoms. Then Pyles will say that this electrons hopping here with one electron per site will make the system unstable, and it will dimerize in the following way. That is, these two atoms will come together and so on. Now, nothing prevents, from energy point of view, these two atoms coming together. And so on. So, this is type A ground state and type B. Now, in this case, what you will find is there are two atoms at the edges which do not know what to do, because I have even number of atoms. So, I have one unpaired fellow, another unpaired fellow. And that is essentially what is happening here. So, even if I have polyacetylene, if I have even number of carbon atoms, there is a possibility I will have a boundary state. Now, it turns out the existence of this boundary state, when you go from this ground state to another ground state, can be explained in terms of Berry curvature and topology. That is what I plan to do in the next few minutes. So, I am supposed to, let us see. I have 10 minutes, right?
Yeah, I have 10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, sure.
A little later, so.
Okay. So, yeah, very quick introduction to Berry phase. Now, Berry phase comes in the context of adiabatic change of some parameter in a gapped quantum system. In fact, incidentally, it's also very important in the context of what's called adiabatic quantum computing. You may have heard about D-wave. So, basically what you do is, you start with the quantum system in some ground state, there's a lot of degeneracy, and then you change some parameter adiabatically and move in the ground state manifold. And then in the process, you end up doing some quantum computation. So, Berry phase is very fundamental in those things. So, what Berry said was, suppose I have a quantum state which is characterized by some number of parameters R, some, you know. Now, I have a system with a gap, and I adiabatically change the parameter so that the gap remains finite. So, then Berry argued . So, let me write it down. This is some eigenstate characterized by the number n, and then this eigenstate depends on the parameter n. So, I can write down the Schrodinger equation for time independent Schrodinger equation for this. This is, you know, I'm just rewriting time independent Schrodinger equation. Now, what I say is, this parameter R starts depending on time, or I tune it by hand. Then I can define at every time a instantaneous eigenstate. Nothing prevents me from defining it, because it may not satisfy the original time dependent Schrodinger equation, but still I can define time dependent instantaneous eigenstate like this. Okay. But now, what is the relevance of this instantaneous eigenstate to the real eigenstate? Because real eigenstate is something that you should find out by evolving the system with the time dependent Hamiltonian. Now, Berry's argument was that whenever you have a gap system, and when you do it slow enough, you can make good use of this instantaneous eigenstate plus a very important correction, which is called the Berry phase. In other words, what I want to do is, now I want to solve the time dependent Schrodinger equation. I have told you that my parameters have become time dependent. Then, in general, when I solve it, I will have So this is a problem I have to solve. And in general, this is difficult to solve because we have a complicated time domain. But Berry argued that if you have slow evolution, you change the parameter adiabatically, you can make use of this instantaneous eigenstate with perhaps some modification. So what Berry said was that the real eigenstate, let me count, will be related to the instantaneous eigenstate, which I write, times some phase. It's an ansatz. Because I have a large gap, and instantaneous eigenstate should be meaningful. So I make this ansatz that the real eigenstate, when I solve the Schrodinger equation, should have this form. So if that be the case, then I can test my ansatz. What I can do is I can take this ansatz and substitute it in the Schrodinger equation and find out the wave function for a equation for theta, which is what Berry does. When you do that, what you find is this theta becomes I will explain all these things. What I do is I take this ansatz and substitute it in the Schrodinger equation and integrate it. I get an expression for theta, which is this. Is a very important equation. Just it follows from Schrodinger equation, and if you make this ansatz, it tells you that there is an extra phase factor, and the first one is something that you recognize immediately what it is. Suppose there is no time variation of the parameter, this is a standard time dependent part of eigenfunctions e to the power of I e naught t. This is what you will get. So if there is no time dependence t prime, this will pull out and you will get a time. So this is the standard phase oscillation of time dependent eigenstates. But this is non-trivial. The second part which Berry obtained is non-trivial. It tells you that this extra, there is an extra phase which is a measure of overlap between the changing instantaneous eigenstates. You look, this is an eigenstate at time t prime. This kind of pushes it by taking a time derivative overlap. Now this is called the Berry phase. Now this has become very, very important in many, many problems, and also there is topology behind it. So this is something standard derivation you must have seen in many places. So now what I am going to do is, I am going to just rewrite this. That is, this can be written as derivative with respect to R. And then you can have dr by dt, and then you can get it of t, then you get r. This is very important. So then it, what it happens is r naught to r final. So I have converted the integral with respect to time with respect to the curve in the space of R, because I have a space R and I start from R naught and end up with some RT, R final time t. So originally I had an integration along this line from t 0 to t. Now I, because I had a very simple form, I replace the time derivative by this R derivative, and then what I have is I have an integral in the space of the parameter which I am changing. So this is called the Berry phase, which is often denoted by gamma n. Okay. So this is the, and in particular, this is called a very, starts looking like a vector potential. For a reason, I will explain. Okay. Now, having done this, now you, Berry observes and others, like Barry Simon and others, whenever I am talking about wave function in Hilbert space, there is a phase redundancy. That is, I can give me an eigenstate, I can multiply it by any arbitrary phase, it's not going to change my physics. So that's where the ray representation and the standard representation comes. So when you put that, then you see if you have a Berry phase connecting two points which forms an open curve, there is some gauge redundancy. But however, when you go on a closed path, that is, instead of going from R0 to R0, suppose you come from, you start from this point and return to the same point, something remarkable happens here. This integral has, there is no gauge redundancy. So that is where this, okay. So now what you notice is what you are doing is you are moving in some parameter space adiabatically, and whatever correction to your instantaneous eigenstates that you were talking about starts appearing like a vector potential, as if this particle is seeing some fictitious vector potential in the parameter space. There is no electricity or no magnetism, but however, the mathematically it starts looking like an external magnetic field. And in particular, it looks like a Baumgartner effect, because when I come close to, then the thing is independent of the gauge choice that I have. Whatever gauge transformation I do, it doesn't appear there. So it starts becoming more and more like vector potential that you come across in electrodynamics. So this is called Berry curvature and Berry's vector potential. Now, I have to stop here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the next lecture, which will be tomorrow or day after tomorrow,
right,
I will do the actual Berry curvature calculation for this by doing some adiabatic transport of polyacetylene from one ground state to another ground state and see some non-trivial something called Chern number. And that is behind all these fantastic developments. By the way, just today while searching, I found out a very nice lecture by Duncan Haldane, his Nobel Prize lecture. There's a PowerPoint available. He starts from quantum chemistry and develops application of this topological insulator idea to quantum Hall effect and spin Hall system and a variety of things. So you may like to, I can send it, you can put it in the, So it has a lot of references and a lot of detailed exposition in a PowerPoint presentation. And I also told about ICTS lectures. That lecture has beautiful lectures by my friend Rajaram Nityananda and Professor Mukunda, and Michael Berry was also there, about Berry phase in various contexts. So students may enjoy looking at it. By the way, historically, Berry phase was found out in the context of optics by Pancharatnam. So it was called, it's also called Pancharatnam Berry phase. So it's a very beautiful history behind it, you know, there are some discussions about it in there. So because light wave is a wave, so finally this phase accumulation is a property of wave equation rather than anything about Schrodinger wave. So later people have, in fact, when Michael Berry visited Bangalore, Rajaram Nityananda, my friend, told Michael about Pancharatnam's work. So it's called Pancharatnam Berry phase, and very beautiful connections have, many, many things have happened. Anyway, I'll stop here. And then please feel free to ask me questions. I'm in my office anytime if things were not clear. Thank you.